we put this symposium together, and it's been several years that we were working on this. And Raj and I talked, and Dave Songstad talked, and a bunch of us visited about what we needed to do and a topic for a symposium. We came up with locally adaptive management impacts and challenges. What we've tried to do is we've tried to put together a program that deals from policies type questions to how do we actually try to do some stuff. And so what we're going to try to address is what limits yield. And so as we think about increasing yield, we'll have a couple talks that talk about what limits yields, developing locally based solutions for increasing food production, links with genetics. And one of the areas that I think is really important, taking advantage of local wisdoms. And I think this is often something that we underestimate, the importance of that knowledge on a local basis for adapting and actually implementing practices that can help us solve problems. One of the things that I think over the long term is we forget, and this is a discussion that I had with one of our faculty members. I was invited to come in and talk for our introductory plant science new agronomists. We invite them to come, well, we require them to take a class called What is an Agronomist type of thing. And we have about 100 students in there. And we had one molecular biologist who was giving what's a molecular biologist, and I was giving the section what's an agronomist and what kind of career opportunities. And what Fedora was saying was interesting, and somewhere we've lost the understanding from a large percentage of our scientists that agriculture creates wealth, and it's that wealth that we create in agriculture that pays school teachers and it pays faculty members and it pays, builds factories and hospitals and homes. And somewhere in that whole discussion, we've forgotten that. And that agriculture is critical for so much of what we do, and it's critical for our rural economies, and that whole part is absolutely essential for maintaining the rural health that we have in our country. So what we've done is we put together a series of discussions myself. I'm going to start a discussion. Gail Buchanan, he'll introduce himself, I'm sure. He's been an undersecretary, is that right, Gail? And he's going to talk from a policy perspective. And Dave Songstad recommended Gail. He's listened to Gail, and Dave have worked together for many years. And Dave recommended Gail for filling this an opportunity to talk from a policy perspective. Paul will talk, Raj. We had on our fourth person there, you can see that Sharon Clay person. She wasn't originally there. What happened is we had a producer that was going to come in and talk. His son died, and he was unwilling to leave home. And so at the last minute, I asked Sharon if she's willing to come in and talk on some of the molecular stuff that she's been doing with applied sciences. And so she'll talk on that. Fran will talk. Bob will talk a little about increasing profits. And we'll finish up with Newell. And so I think we've got a really good program. Hopefully everybody will stick around and learn some of the and take some of the lessons that people have to say. Following this discussion, we'll then meet in this room and have a precision farming community discussion, and we've got a series of things to discuss. We've got some money that we need to decide about. We've got leadership that we'd like to talk about. We've got symposium perhaps for next year that we'd like to discuss. And so after this symposium, if people would like to stick around for a group meeting, that would be great for our community. So that brings me up to what I wanted to talk about, and hopefully everything will work. What I wanted to talk about is feeding the world sustainably. And I'm talking about this question, it's something that I've been thinking about for a fair length of time. Fran and a bunch of us had a lot of discussions over this the past year. But I think as we think about these things, we oftentimes think about these things as technology is going to fill these problems. And I like to think that there's no universal solution. And that's the reason I like to think about locally adapted systems that may have a lot of success. This is a question that people have been thinking about for 10,000 years. This is not a new problem. This is something that we've been working on for 10,000 years. And the question that we have is how do we meet the goals of producing food without destroying the land that's producing those foods. So I wanted to start with a series of case studies and discuss it. I'm not going to show any data today, so I'm just going to talk about a little some case studies. And one of the ones that I've been working with is what happened in South America relative to the Incas and their successes and perhaps some of their failures. But they were dealing with this problem of climate variability probably 1,000 years ago. And one of the things that they were doing is they used their infrastructure to build cities similar to what we did. They used their wealth that they created to build roads. Many of these roads are still working today. They built bridges. They built warehouses where they stored their foods. And then they started thinking about precision farming. And I'm going to use it in the sense of precision farming. And they created these terraces that would go across these landscapes. And they have landscapes and mountains that are just full of these terraces like this. And the reason why I started thinking about working with the Incas is we had a visiting scientist in our lab for the last 3 years who was working on these systems down there. And so what these terraces are is they put a wall, and then they put rocks on the bottom of this, and then they put some gravel, and then they put river, then they put topsoil here that they bring in from the stream banks. So they haul all that topsoil up. Okay, so this isn't stuff that's eroding down. It's all this topsoil that they're bringing from down here, carrying it up here, and putting that topsoil on the top. Now, the advantage of this system that it has is it has an ability to trap heat. So the sunlight comes down, strikes the wall, bounces down, and it's trapped. And so they've increased their ability to trap heat. And so they've improved their ability to produce food because they've actually trapping heat in this system. They also came up with a system where they're producing crops with streams between them, and then they're able to produce their crops. Now, these water banks actually trapped heat as well. They also invested in agricultural research, and this is at the Moray Station. And what people oftentimes talk about this is the Inca Agricultural Center. And what they did here is they through this system through these experiments, they were able to duplicate the climatic variation that they saw across their empire. So down here they had one type of climate, up here they had a different type of climate. They use that to produce 70 different plants. They produce plants that can grow in one location in a different location. So what they would then do is they would plant one variety of corn down here, a different variety of corn that was adapted for a more colder environment up here. And so they were able to match their genetics to their locations. Now this was in the 1400s. Okay, so to a large extent, I think we oftentimes, as we're moving forward, we forget to look back. And we lose those wisdoms that we've learned over thousands of years. And we need to take advantage of those wisdoms that we've learned in the past and link those with the technologies that we have today. What do we have today? We have genetics that are absolutely incredible. We have GPS, GIS centers, systems, climatic conditions, that's actually incredible. And this last one down here, this knowledge. And oftentimes, we forget about this knowledge and the importance of that knowledge. We've been having discussions with a lot of our livestock producers in South Dakota, and one of the things that we keep seeing is that every time somebody gets rid of their livestock, all that knowledge is gone. Okay, they move out of livestock because it's hard work, and all of a sudden, the ability to produce livestock at one location is lost. And we need to somehow address those issues, not just how do we do the management, but we need to address this issue relative to how do we keep that locally developed knowledge that makes these systems work and how we move into the future. My second case study I wanted to spend a few minutes and talk about is managing variability in the Great Plains. So as we think about the Great Plains, and where I'm actually, this is South Dakota, where I'm at is right here. We can start thinking about our variability. Oftentimes in our research papers, what we find in our research papers is we see a map that might be average temperature, okay? And so or average rainfall. And so we generate these sorts of maps and we say, well, as I move from south to north, our temperatures drop. And that's oftentimes all the discussion that we have on these topic areas. In reality, we really need to not just think about the average temperatures, but we need to think about this variability. Very similar to what the Incas dealt with, is that they dealt with incredible variation, and we deal with incredible variation. In South Dakota, where I'm at, we have some of the highest climate variability in the U.S. And so as we look at this location here versus something over here by Madison, our variability is much higher here. Our annual variability is much higher than what you might find in Madison. We need to address that variability, and that needs to be integrated into our systems as best we possibly can. We can also look at rainfall. And so as we look at rainfall, we oftentimes think about rainfall decreasing as I go east to west. But we can also look at that question relative to variability in our rainfall, which also in the Great Plains is some of the highest variability that we have in the world. So what do we have to help manage these tools? And what have we done over the past bunch of years? Paul Fixon was involved in a symposium yesterday dealing with what, Great Plains? Paul, is that what you guys were dealing with, the fertilizer records over the past?
More broadly.
But we've got genetics that we've used that are absolutely incredible. But we've got management systems that are dealing with fertilizers. We've got management systems dealing with equipment. We've got management systems dealing with livestock. So we've got new management over the past 40 years. And then we need to address this variability that we see in our production fields, which is oftentimes high water stress areas in our summit areas, low water stress areas in our foot slope areas, that results in this very, very, very strong yield variation. So we put these pieces together, and we start dealing with seeds and populations and fertilizers and knowledge and all that sort of stuff. And what we've generated over this period of time is we've generated yield, increasing yields that increased from the 1940s up to now with corn, which has gone from probably about 10 bushels per acre to somewhere around 150 bushels per acre. So we've seen incredible yield increases. We've seen some yield increases in both soybeans and wheat, but not near as what we've seen in our corn production systems. And so in the Great Plains, this is South Dakota numbers, our yield variability and our ability to manage these systems has greatly improved by not just by genetics, but by the management of these entire systems. What that's resulted in, when we start looking at these systems and we start looking at, well, where are we actually growing stuff, we can start seeing that in the Great Plains, we grow an awful lot of wheat, corn in the Great Plains. And as we start going from east to west, we start moving from relationships between a negative relationship between corn yields and rainfall to positive relationships, which would suggest that these systems out here are water limited versus some of the systems over here may be too much water in their actual rainfall relative to corn yields. We can do the same sorts of things for soybeans. And so in soybean yields, we see these blue areas here are very strong correlations between yield and rainfall, areas that are very water-stressed areas versus these sorts of areas over here, which would suggest that you almost have too much rainfall for optimizing soybean yields. So as we put these systems together, what we've seen is a couple things. Farms are getting large. Many rural communities have been put at risk. And to maintain our ability and our knowledge, we need to figure out some way of how do we save these rural communities. How do we prevent depopulation, school closure, aging workforce, loss of local expertise? How do we do all that sort of stuff? So what we did is we started looking at this question, is how do we try to reduce the rate of losses? And we started thinking, well, one of the ways we can perhaps do that is increase the length of time that raw products are in the communities. As opposed to exporting the grain directly out of our communities, we want to increase the length of time that grain's actually in our communities. So we looked at this from a carbon mass balance of perspective. And then what we did is we did an economic analysis of this entire system. And so we looked at a couple different systems. Grain is produced and exported. Grain is sold for ethanol production and distillers' grains and fed to livestock. And so we've integrated the livestock into this. And then we looked at the grain and stover being sold for ethanol production. So this is our model where we're selling corn and we're going to export it off the farm. Whether we use it for beef or ethanol, we're just going to export it off the farm. We can sell it for fuel, or we have a system that says, let's sell the corn. We're going to use part of it for ethanol. We're going to use part of it for livestock. Some of that distiller's grain from the ethanol then goes back into the livestock manure and goes, so we have this cycle of these systems. So how do we compare these systems that are different? One of the things that we need to be aware of is that when we do these sorts of analysis, we need to be aware that we have to identify our perspective. Where we're sitting and looking at these problems might generate a different answer. If I'm a rural community, I might generate one answer. If I'm somebody sitting in a city, I might generate a different answer. And so we need to look at these from a different, from a variety of perspectives. As we think about this ethanol, about one-third gets produced for ethanol, one-third is distiller's grain, and one-third is lost as CO2. And the question is, how do we try to balance this whole system? When we produce ethanol, basically what we're doing is we're converting the sugars into ethanol. And so if we look at the crude protein that's in this grain, we have about 720 pounds. Stover has some. And so our total protein that we have in that system, I'm back, is we're going to have a little around 950 pounds per acre of total protein. Now, if I look at the distiller's grains, we actually have more right here in our, when we use it for when we use it for producing ethanol than we started with. Okay, and so in our production of the ethanol, we haven't lost protein. What we've done is we've lost starch. And so as we start looking at diets for livestock, we can see, well, there's periods of time that there's a crude protein deficit, which if I compare that to an average hay crop, this suggests that during this period of time right here, we need to add some additives. If we look at perhaps in producing beef, there's a deficit for a large percent of the time if I would just be comparing that to feeding that a regular hay. And so there's opportunities relative to low protein that's in these diets. And so one of the questions that we have is, if I fed these materials to the livestock, could we create wealth that's going to help maintain our rural communities by keeping that money in those local communities for a longer period of time? So we looked at these questions relative to soil sustainability, and we looked at, well, if I just produce grain, I'm going to lose about 150 pounds of nitrogen from that system in that exported grain. If I use this integrated system where I run that stuff back through the livestock, we're only going to lose about 40 pounds. And if I sell my grain in Stover, I'm going to lose about 190 pounds. Same thing goes for P205. We start looking at our carbon return. We start having the most carbon return when we return all the Stover. If I remove the Stover, I'm going to lose more carbon. And so if we look at from this perspective, from a farmer's perspective, these numbers right here are really important. These numbers right here are really important. And it suggests that this system right here might be relatively sustainable. Now, if we start thinking about this problem from a profit center analysis, we can start thinking what that's going to do to our local economies. If I sell the grain, 139 bushels dollars per acre we're going to produce. If I use it in livestock, we're going to double that return. And so the livestock gives us an ability to produce the wealth that our small communities need to maintain their school systems. Maybe. So one of the things we need to do is one of the things we can think about and perhaps in our community is how do we integrate this entire system? How do we integrate the crop production with the ethanol production, with the livestock, bringing that manure, but putting a system in place, something like this, relative to saying, well, let's just worry about this piece or let's just worry about this piece, but we need to put that entire system in place because that's the process of how we create the wealth that our small communities are going to require to be competitive into the future. So where have I been? Produce locally, derive wealth, which supports families and keeps schools open and increase local diversity. Take advantage of local products. And when I'm talking about taking advantage of local products, it's not necessarily local vegetables, even though that might be part of the question or the answer. It's really we need to keep those products local as long as we can because it's that process that keeps that money in place, that keeps our rural communities functioning. Manure is returned to the land, and the manure gains most of the nutrients that were contained in that grain and Stover that was removed. So that's where I'm at, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to respond to those. If not, we'll move on to our next speaker, and thank you for your attention.